Reducing absences. First question that comes to my mind is, that is the teacher the decision maker about this? Is the teacher the one deciding whether or not the pupils show up at school? It wasn't that way when I was a teacher, and I don't think it's that way now either. A teacher can most certainly reduce distractions, as we will hear about, and reduce late work, as we're going to hear about. But reducing absences, maybe I'd rather talk about reducing waistlines. I have a few ideas there. Unlike distractions and late work, teachers can hardly speak directly into this. Yes, we can perhaps try to have good health practices and teach students how to manage their sniffles and sneezes and coughs so that they don't get sick so much. But that only goes so far, really. Now, there are just two observations, and maybe you would call them understandings, about this whole subject. The first is that sicknesses will happen. And we as teachers just need to learn to live with that and be gracious about it. We can do our part, as I mentioned, to reduce sicknesses, but really, that's not where the rub is. I don't think that most of us are disturbed too much when a student stays home because they're sick. The other observation I would offer is that parents will sometimes take children out of school at inopportune times. You wouldn't have made that decision yourself. There will be that camping trip during the first week of school. I've had it. Not the camping trip. There will be a trip to Hawaii for 12 days in February. There will be fishing trips. There will be shopping trips. The relatives are in town. Mom needs help. Dad's behind. We got home too late from a trip on Sunday. I opened the freezer and a chunk of frozen cheese fell out and landed on my little toe. My cat had kittens. These are things that we've heard. The bailer boat broke. Grandma died in Peru. Dad twisted his knee. And did we mention the common cold? What can be done? What can the teacher do? Employ an acronym, FOMO. FOMO simply means fear of missing out. If we can make school exciting enough, at least that magnetism perhaps will pull the students to school. Working towards making school enjoyable and interesting perhaps is the most a teacher can do to reduce absences. So when a student considers skipping, they realize they're going to have no stories, no story time, no laughs, no current events discussions, no wonderful games at recess, no classes, no sympathetic guide to help them with their studies, no $10 in the classroom economy system for showing up, all alone, all sadness, all loneliness, lots of FOMO. We hope. But all this proves to be just a trifle inadequate, it seems, when you're competing against fishing and hunting and shopping or chilling with out-of-state friends. So a few suggestions. What can we really do? I'm not really sure, but we'll keep trying. You be there yourself. Lead with your example. If it's easy for us to skip school, well, we can expect that it will likewise be easy for our students to skip. Another thing we can do is speak kindly about school and about school books and about learning. You see, it's not real encouraging to have to drink from a polluted fountain. And I think sometimes, somehow, it just comes out, comments that pollute that fountain of learning. And it comes sometimes from the teacher. Beware of your speech. Like I said before, reduce your absences, especially when it comes to the peripheral things in life that are nice, the weddings, the baby showers, the bridal showers, the hunting, the fishing seasons. I'm not sure how much that should really affect teachers and still be legal. Another thing you can do is make gentle, factual appeal to the board and to the parents. Sometimes the raw data is all that it takes to change some things. I remember giving some raw data one time. I believe it was about in March, where I had 9 students that year, and I'm thinking it was 114 absences to date. And as I just simply shared that raw data, it made a difference. Another thing I would suggest by way of a negative, don't push for policy about this. Don't push for policy. Some of the most lengthy and convoluted school policies that I ever saw in print relates to absences. You see, if you're going to make a policy about an absence, you first of all need to define what is an unexcused and what is an excused absence. And these things, as much thought as we give them, as long as the list is, somehow pupils and parents find a way to break it off center a little bit. And then you're not quite sure what to do. The penalties for unexcused absences are never pleasant to come up with either. One school I was aware of had a $1 penalty per unexcused absence. So you had to be sure that it fit solidly in the list of unexcused absence, and then there was a fine. And the fine went to the teacher. At least that was right. But then the parents sometimes ask for a reduction of the fine if they're taking off 12 days. I know. Another thing you can do to reduce absences is you can reduce the impact of the absence. We've already been getting you thinking along the lines of just getting used to the idea that there are going to be absences. There are going to be sicknesses that we need to graciously accept. And parents will make decisions that we wouldn't personally make ourselves. But how do you reduce the impact of absences? Well, maybe you're not a form type of individual, but I found a form to be helpful. Two forms, in fact. One form was one that I would fill out of what was missing from the student, what assignment was missing, and I would have that right ready to pull out of my podium, and I could put it on a clipboard, and I could put it back in there again, and as soon as it came up that there's a missing assignment, with very little effort and very little impact, I could just simply write down missing math, thus and so. I put it down here again. And then that clipboard went on a specified spot on the wall, that when the student came back to school, there it was, and there it hung. And I didn't have to go over a lot of things with them because it was already made. So a form can help. The other form was one that I gave to one of their buddies or one of their friends, and their friends had to fill out that form as far as what was assigned that day and anything else that they missed. Students didn't exactly enjoy filling those out for their friends, but finally it was kind of fair because everybody has a day off, you know. And then that form would be sent home with one of the siblings or somehow get into the hands of the student that was missing. You can reduce the impact of absences by having a bit of a policy about the number of days that are permitted to catch up. You see, if this just stretches out on and on and on indefinitely, especially for shorter absences, I'm not talking about the ones where they're gone for, you know, a week or more, but if it's a day or two, the number of days to catch up seems to be expedient to help to reduce the impact of absences. As a matter of policy, I gave the same number of days they were off to catch up for unexcused absences. In other words, if they were supposed to be at school and just really weren't. But if they were sick, they got double the number of days that they were off to be caught up. And after that, we just take down the clipboard and take down the paper, and nobody would see it again, and no credit was given either. I put a zero in the grade book. Now, I'd like to speak just a little bit yet. If you're here as a parent or as a board member, I'd like to tell you kindly why your teacher hates absences and probably always will. And it's very simple. It's because we can't have school without pupils. A cook can't serve meals without eaters. A mom can't do laundry if the dirty clothes are in a locked bedroom, and so on. Another reason we hate absences is because it seems like parental and board expectations tend to remain about the same regardless of whether or not students are present. And that simply is not possible. You can't miss school and not have negative impact on a child's education. Another thing is it creates lots of extra work. How many times do we need to teach the same lesson? Do we have one bell or two? Thank you.
one of my friends found out what my topic was about. And he made the comment to me, he said, Austin, he said, you'll never be able to reduce distractions in your classroom as long as you're in there. Well, at first I laughed with him, along with him, but I started thinking there's probably some truth to that, actually. Because I am the teacher in the classroom, and we'll get to some of those thoughts on that here in a bit. But I'm going to ask a question. Does it bother you, or will it bother you, if your students are distracted? If you can tell, if they're sitting there with that glazed look in their eyes. They're looking right at you, but you can tell they're looking right through you. Does that bother you? It should, I think. What we do about it will probably differ. A little story that I heard. I don't remember where I heard this story. I want to say it came from Fish Wrappers, I think. I don't know if I have all the details right, but I think I have it enough to get the story together. There was a professor once, a very, very good professor, who had this one pet peeve, and that was when a student was not paying attention. It just drove him crazy. And so one day, one of his students decided, you know what, I'm going to see how long he can take one of his students being distracted. So math class started, and the student propped his chin on his hand and started staring out the window. 30 seconds went by, and the professor was out of his chair, up at the board, writing equations down, just going after it. Student just stared out the window. A minute passed, and the professor was now in front of the student, still talking about the class, gesturing with huge gestures, talking with gusto, and the student just stared out the window. A minute and a half went past. The professor was back up at the front of the room, just rattling off joke after joke after joke, and the rest of the class was in stitches, and the student just stared out the window. Finally, at 2 minutes, the professor stopped and said, "What is so interesting out the window?" So does it bother you, and how will you go about preventing it? Now, back to my thoughts about myself being the biggest distraction. I do the most talking in my classroom, after all, or at least I should. And there are things that I have noticed. Sorry, let me back up a little bit. My first year of school, I was having trouble keeping my room quiet and in a good studying atmosphere. I remember one time the principal and I were talking, and he gave me an observation that he observed from second grade. The way that she would help her students, it's a small thing. All of you will help your students answer questions. But how would you do that? She would go to their desk, she'd kneel down beside them and whisper to help them. Yeah, that's very non-distracting to the other students. I don't know if I ever got the whisper part down pat exactly, but I did find out that I could reduce it distractions by lowering my voice, talking in a quieter voice. But the biggest thing that I found, and it was things I was doing unintentionally, was when I was presenting the lesson. I had this horrible habit back there. Now, I would normally have papers on my podium, and I had this habit of just every couple of 10, 15 seconds, I'd pick the papers up, and I'd straighten them on the podium and set them back down. I'd talk, and I'd pick the papers back up and straighten them again and set them back down. And all the students, they took them a while to say anything about it, but finally they admitted that was rather distracting to them. Another one I would do, I don't know if I can do it with a pen very well, but I would spin the chocolate. I'd have a piece of chalk in my hand, and I'd spin it in my fingers while I'm talking, or maybe while I'm listening to them say something, and all of a sudden I'd lose my grip, and the chalk would fall. You know, chalk on tile just goes everywhere, and then you got to bend over and pick up the pieces and clean it up, and it kind of was distracting as well to the students. Those things are subtle, and those may be things your students will have to tell you about. My students were happy to tell me about those, and I tried to work on them. You know, you're up there talking, and you accidentally do this, and you see that grin spread throughout your students, that look in their eyes. You're like, oh yeah, I just did that again. Sorry, you apologize and move on. Or, unfortunately, I still think the chalk thing. That was just kind of habit. I don't know. I don't know if I ever got over that habit. One of the long-term teachers here, in fact, he said that you're not a good teacher if you don't use your chalkboard. So I constantly had a piece of chalk in my hand. And, you know, you're listening to students say something, you're saying something. It's It's amazing what that little piece of chalk, what motion it can get into without you really thinking about it. And the students can pick up on those things. And if they're looking for something to distract them, that'll distract them. What other things will distract students? Well, there were a lot, actually. There were a lot of other things I've found. When you're in a small school, and you've got a classroom just across the hall, you've got a classroom above you, there are things that happen that can be distracting. The other class is having music class, and they're singing off-key. Your students very quickly lose the attention on their schoolwork and start smiling and giggling and focusing on the sounds coming from the other classroom. Or you're sitting there nice and peacefully, and there's a random and loud thump or crash from the room above. I don't know what happened. Like maybe somebody's desk fell over or something, but hopefully the person wasn't in it. But those things can take a little bit of time sometimes for your students to get back into, especially if they were focused before then. It can take a little bit of time for them to get back into their focused attitude. Obviously, those aren't things you can necessarily change. But you can be aware of that when you're teaching. Be aware of those kind of things, how it might affect the other students. I remember high school, in the school I taught at, they had a morning workout they would do. And some mornings it was raining. They would do their workout in the room above us. And part of their workout involved jumping jacks. Some days it was jump roping. And I'll let you imagine what your students were doing when they were upstairs jump roping or doing jumping jacks. The students are sitting there like this, making sure that ceiling is still where it's supposed to be. You might as well forget about schoolwork while that's going on for a couple minutes. Another thing that is or can be distracting, and this is something that will always be in your classroom, and that's, well, I guess it depends on where the students keep their books. But if they keep their books in a locker, there's always going to be people needing to get up and walk back to their locker and get a book or put a book away, whatever the case may be. And that can be distracting for students, especially students that are easily distracted, because it is true that some are much more easily distracted than others. And can you prevent that distraction? In my experience, I would say no, you can't, but you can really, really help if you have some sort of a procedure. Something that the students know that this is what the teacher expects them to do. When they need to hand in a paper, the teacher expects them to do it this way. When we are changing classes, the teacher expects you to walk back to your locker, get your book, and return to your desk immediately. Those kind of things can help. One thing I decided to do the second year to help avoid certain situations, because I ran into this my first year. Okay, so I'm helping a student, and there's another student that's got his hand up in the air. It's waving. And I tell them, well, just wait until I'll be there in a bit. I want to finish with the student. So they would wait. I would finish with the student. I'd go over to them, and I'd say, what do you need? And they'd say, can I go to the bathroom? Yes, you may. I don't know. It depended who the student was, but some of them could be pretty distracting with trying to let you know what their need was. And that's a valid need. So my second year, I decided to change my policy a little bit. And I had two keys on my classroom door with a thread tied to the key that you hung around your neck. And you were allowed to go use the restroom whenever you wanted to if that key for your gender was there. If the key was not there, you had to wait till it got back. That cut down on me needing to answer those hands up in the air, some of them waving, some of them not necessarily. But just little things like that can help with distractions in your classroom. But regardless of how hard you try, there's always going to be something that can distract a student and that will distract certain students, especially if they don't feel like working. So make sure you keep them busy. Also, impress on the students the importance of staying on task, focusing. And then do your part and make sure your classroom atmosphere is such that they can easily remain on that task without a lot of distractions. Of course, you can't help some of the distractions. Like one day, we were sitting in our classroom, busily studying. It was between classes, so it was quiet. It was great study time. And all of a sudden, a foosball hit our door at a high rate of speed. I was almost pulling out 17 students from the plaster roof of my classroom. But those kind of things you can't always help. However, the things that you can help, especially if they're about you, things you do unintentionally that distract your students, they'll pick up on it. And if you ask them, they'll probably tell you.
Reducing late work. Tom appeared on the sidewalk with a bucket of whitewash and a long-handled brush. He surveyed the fence, and all gladness left him, and a deep melancholy settled down upon his spirit. 30 yards of board fence, 9 feet high. Life to him seemed hollow, and existence but a burden. Sighing, he dipped his brush and passed it along the topmost plank, repeated the operation, did it again, compared the insignificant whitewashed streak with a far-reaching continent of unwhitewashed fence, and sat down on a tree box, discouraged. Jim came skipping out at the gate with a tin pail and singing Buffalo Gals, bringing water from the town pump had always been hateful work in Tom's eyes before. But now it did not strike him so. He remembered that there was company at the pump. White, mulatto, and negro boys and girls were always there waiting their turns, resting, trading playthings, quarreling, fighting, skylarking. And he remembered that although the pump was only 150 yards off, Jim never got back with a bucket of water under an hour. And even then, somebody generally had to go after him. Tom said, "Say, Jim, I'll fetch the water if you'll whitewash some." I believe the best way to reduce late work is to prevent before it happens. And so I'm going to continue reading and bring out 6 points of good ways perhaps we can reduce late work in our classrooms. And right here, Tom realizes that if he wants the fence whitewashed, he might have to do something too. Be diligent yourself. Equip your students with the tools to do the work. If they have a report to do, make sure you have those study books on hand so they can actually do that report. Skipping a bit. Tom got out his worldly wealth and examined it. Bits of toys, marbles, and trash. Enough to buy an exchange of work, maybe, but not half enough to buy so much as half an hour of pure freedom. So he returned his straitened means to his pockets and gave up the ideas of trying to buy the boys. At this dark and hopeless moment, an inspiration burst upon him. Nothing less than a great, magnificent inspiration. Skipping a bit, he took up his brush and went tranquilly to work. Skipping a bit, Tom surveyed his last touch with the eye of an artist. Then he gave his brush another gentle sweep and surveyed the result as before. Ben ranged up alongside him. Tom's mouth watered for the apple, but he stuck to his work. Point two, be inspirational. This is maybe the most important thing. Teach the lesson in a way that your students want to dig in and do it. Tom contemplated the boy a bit and said, "What do you call work?" "Why, ain't that work?" Tom resumed his whitewash and answered carelessly, "Well, maybe it is, and maybe it ain't. All I know is it suits Tom Sawyer." Work suits Tom. Expect work to be done. Make completed work part of the culture of your classroom. "Oh, come now, you don't mean to let on that you like it." The brush continued to move. "Like it? Well, I don't see why I oughtn't to like it. Does a boy get a chance to whitewash a fence every day?" That put the thing in a new light. Ben stopped nibbling his apple. Tom swept his brush daintily back and forth, stepped back to note the effect, added a touch here and there, criticized the effect again. Ben watching every move and getting more and more interested, more and more absorbed. Presently he said, "Say, Tom, let me whitewash a little." Tom considered, was about to consent, but he altered his mind. No, I reckon it would hardly do, Ben. You see, Aunt Polly's awful particular about this fence. Right here on the street, you know. If it was a back fence, I wouldn't mind, and she wouldn't. Yeah, she's awful particular about this fence. It's got to be done very carefully. I reckon there ain't one boy in 1,000, maybe 2,000, that can do it the way it's got to be done. Next point, help them own their work. To take pride in it. Go ahead and set the bar high. Go ahead and put a due date on it. Excellence inspires. Skipping. Tom gave up the brush with reluctance in his face, but alacrity in his heart. And while the late steamer Big Missouri worked and sweated in the sun, the retired artist sat on a barrel in the shade close by, dangling his legs, munched his apple, and planned the slaughter of more innocents. There was no lack of material. Boys happened along every little while. They came to jeer, but remained to whitewash. By the time Ben was fagged out, Tom had traded the next chance to Billy Fisher for a kite in good repair. And when he played out, Johnny Miller brought in a dead rat and a string to swing it with. And so on, hour after hour. Point five, assign bite-sized pieces. Don't overwhelm your students. And when the middle of the afternoon came, from being a poor, poverty-stricken boy in the morning, Tom was literally rolling in wealth. He had, besides the thing before mentioned, 12 marbles, part of a Jew's harp, a piece of blue bottle glass to look through, a spool cannon, a key that wouldn't unlock anything, a fragment of chalk, a glass stopper of a decanter, a tin soldier, a couple of tadpoles, 6 firecrackers, a kitten with only one eye, a brass doorknob, a dog collar but no dog, the handle of a knife, 4 pieces of orange peel, and a dilapidated old window sash. He had had a nice, good, idle time all the while, plenty of company, and the fence had 3 coats of whitewash on it. If he hadn't run out of whitewash, he would have bankrupted every boy in the village. Tom said to himself that it was not such a hollow world after all. He had discovered a great law of human action without knowing it, namely, that in order to make a man or a boy covet a thing, it is only necessary to make the thing difficult to attain. If he had been a great and wise philosopher like the writer of this book, he would now have comprehended that work consists of whatever a body is obliged to do, and that play consists of whatever a body is not obliged to do. And this would help him understand why constructing artificial flowers or performing on a treadmill is work, while rolling 10 pins or climbing Mont Blanc is only amusement. There are wealthy gentlemen in England who drive 4-horse passenger coaches 20 or 30 miles on a daily line in the summer because the privilege costs them considerable money. But if they were offered wages for the service, they would turn it into work and they would resign. The boy mused a while over the substantial change that had taken place in his worldly circumstances and then wended toward headquarters to report. And the 6th point I couldn't find in there specifically, except if we work backward, and that is reward the students for work that is accomplished. Someone gave the beautiful idea. If during math period the math assignment is finished, why not dismiss for recess early? It's going to give a good incentive. So the best way to reduce late work is to prevent it. But suppose late work happens, what is the cure? 2 ideas. Neither original with me. One is use a pink slip. So if someone has late work, hand them a pink slip that they have to fill out, especially make it nice and pink, and put their name on it, the date, the work that they didn't do, and then their lame excuse for why it's not done. And they need to fill out that slip, hand it back into you. Several things you're doing is you're making that student actually think up why he didn't do his work. You're making him own responsibility for his mistakes. You're making it public and pink. And you're creating a paper trail so that if this is a habit-forming thing, you can go to that student's dad and say, yeah, it is true. He missed 3 assignments last week. That sounds like a good idea. I would use it in my classroom for sure. Another idea, which I got from Ron Someone in a book, and he teaches in New York, I think, or used to, and this is keep a posted record in your classroom of days without work. We did put a little Scrabble table up on the wall, and I got little numbers, and the students would change it at the end of the day. If in this day we went through the whole day without late work, I really challenge you to track this in your classrooms and see if you can do better than I can. I'm sure you can. But we included anything. So if they miss one blank in their maybe social studies, they miss one blank, that counts as a miss. They miss part B in English, that counts as a miss. So set up what counts as misses, first of all, make that clear in your classroom, and then see if you can go a whole day with a whole class not being late. You know what? It's really, really hard to get to 3 days. And what Ron does is he goes, I don't know if he sets the bar at 5 or 7 or 3 days, somewhere in there, and he says, I'm going to bring you a treat if you can do this. And this past year, I got to confess, like I keep good track in my plan book, then I would write person's name down at the bottom of it. And we'll flip through that plan book and see if we could ever get 5 days. And we just couldn't and couldn't and couldn't and couldn't. And what happens, of course, when you get 4 and that person gets late work, then there's good pressure from the peers to, oh, you know, now we don't get it. And then bring in seafood or whatever, give them a treat for their performance. You can lead the horse to water, but you can't make him drink. You can take the boy to school, but you can't make him think. And Jonathan suggested you can't even bring the boy to school. But it's again, something that I think largely, to come back to the first point, to be inspirational about what you're doing. So inspiration, determination, and much patience to you as you reduce late work in this coming year.